writing the protest with the money, we make an amendment to that. So we want to obviously do it elsewhere, not in that bill, which doesn't matter because it isn't an issue, but it shouldn't matter. Chair, I think, I'm just trying to get my notes as well. I think in principle we don't have any issue with reporting. I think the question is just when and how. And generally we do report, but on this one I don't think we've got a problem. The response here will be, I want to see where our lawyers put it in. That's my only issue. And I have 10 members, you see.
Well, the next thing is, we want a gentleman that approached me at the end of the meeting. He submitted to us a proposal.
Mr. Chet.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what is your response to that?
So our response to him is no, because on bringing down the inclusion rate, remember that's been on the issue, and that's always been, it's not a new market
place.
Because obviously, it's saying the lower it is, the more people that come. And the question was finding the balance.
What do you mean, though?
Well,
I read it actually. I had a hard copy for some reason. I had a hard copy. I read it. I actually couldn't see what he was saying, actually, that's new that they haven't discussed. But I thought maybe their members here can see something if those are more familiar to the issue. So does anybody want to comment? Mr. Chet, is it?
Mr. Chet, yeah.
Yeah. Anybody want to say something? Mr. Lee?
Chair?
Yeah. Sorry?
Okay. My understanding of your concern was that the program is supposed to run together with the Reserve Bank, which also charges a 5 or a 10% levy, administrative levy or something like that. So you were saying in addition to the taxation of the 40% on assets, there's an extra charge. Maybe if we can get clarity on that. Is there an option to go with SAR or SAR, or are you subjected to tax on the 40% of your assets plus the 10% administrative levy? I think that's what he's saying.
Sorry, somebody wants to do. Let's have Mr. Lee first, and you guys can respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The with regard to the inclusion rate, it is indeed a question of the final cost of declaration, which includes, in the worst case scenario, the sole 10% penalty. In the worst case scenario, it would be a 26% cost to the whoever's increasing the money. And so the question really is not about the actual costs, it's about the implications for declarations or disclosures. Is the rate low enough to attract disclosures or is it not? Now, we don't have any empirical evidence for us to make a value judgment. On the one hand, one would argue that if one knows something is just wrong, the full penalty of the law should be imposed. I mean, that's the way that most of us would look at it. On the other hand, one has to look at it from the point of view of saying, there are some who are saying there are billions and billions of them. No one can tell how much it is. And there is a potential to raise a huge amount of revenue for the state if we make it attractive. So you've got the two point of view. So the one would say a 0% inclusion rate, and the other would say it's narrowed down now to an inclusion rate of 40%. But it's all on subjective views. If we were able to say that a 30% inclusion rate would increase the revenue to the state by 100 billion rand, well then we would have to seriously consider it. But we really don't know what is the implications are.
Yeah, I just want to add on what has just been said now. When we attended the tax endeavor, there was a lady who had done a study on programs like this globally, And she did say that inclusion of participants is rather high, but there's also an issue of the international disclosure program that's coming into play next year, which will in any case force people to disclose the illicit financial flows. So from where I'm sitting, the rate is quite high, but people will disclose in any case because of what's coming ahead.
Tim, I just want to build on where you're at. You know, the kind of narratives that we get around the enforced disclosure is that people aren't very scared. At this, they may well, as history proves that it's going to work, become more and more scared. But right now, it apparently, again, it's all subjective, apparently it's not seen as a great threat at the end.
Yeah, I think we've got to make it an attractive gym. A year ago I had dinner with a very wealthy ex-American that owned a chain store in South Africa. The lady's concluding room asked me, well, the good thing is when you're rich, you go anywhere in the world, doesn't mean that. And the money we're looking for here is with rich people that can, they're not too worried about the international disclosure program. They get caught. They get on the airplane now, in Mauritius or somewhere else. And I can see another story when I was in Texas with the first voluntary disclosure program. I had a few clients come in and we did a calculation and no way back then. We're talking millions of dollars penalty. And they just said, it's not worth it. They walked away. So I think we've got a 40% recovery out. Somewhere between the right thing.
The way this works, maybe it's coming, in Sweden there's this prostitution. So it's only on prostitution that you have. So even if you pay the top marginal rate on there, for 1%, it's only on the 40%. But yeah, I think the key point is we've had this discussion. I'm not sure why the person who submitted is standing so late. This has been in the news. I think that we've been through the issue of the rate, and there is a trade-off. There's no doubt. The lower you make it, the more likely more people will come. And all these, necessarily, I'm very wary of all these mythical, I'm sure they're there, they're not mythical, but the billions don't ever get realized. The issue I have with the judge David as well is that he is very confident more money will come in. But let's see what happens. And that's our approach, because his other point is he wants to extend the time period. Now we have extended it, you know, and we will be doing that. So we don't have a problem with extending it. We do it in this process, right? So end of June, but we are alive, I think, in the budget. Seeing what happens in April, we can easily extend it.
No, I think as a courtesy, we should contact you. I mean, the leader that didn't start, doesn't let him know what I was doing. So, maybe Gloria, between you and I, you could help me a bit to pitch it properly. I could speak to him. But what I want to ask you, what do we have to say? On the issue of the extension of time, that's possible, right? Without the things that we have had an meeting to do for the budget. On the issue of 40% or what are we saying? Because frankly, I don't know if this is maybe for the view. I don't have a view. I'm going to send it to the professional question. More on the basis that there's got a lot of experience and we have been discussing it. But nothing precludes us from making a change. We're not voting on the vote as a second. Yes. So I don't think it's a problem for us to come to a view, but I just don't feel personally. Actually, I'm glad by Gloria and the time it's going to be independent. Anyway, you always see the thing.
Apologies, Mr. Chairman. I kept doing it. I don't know whether you've seen me, and it's very irritating when you're in the chair. How much
no, I don't mind.
I do apologize.
No, I'm very sorry. I did say.
And you managed to say
it.
Thank you. the question of the 14%, I mean, we...
No, I like to find the LR.
It is indeed the case that the people that one pays most attention to are the people you like to help. So at the point that you pay more attention with David than you do with me. But Jim, the rate of inflation, and that's what Jamie wanted, was 50%. And then the Treasury Finance reduced it to 40%. What was the motivation for that? Was it simply just try and make people happy, or was there nothing that guided you on that percentage?
Yeah, how did you know?
Well, I think part of the picture is we said this is not an amnesty. So, in a way, there's a flaw to how low you are. But, you know, sure, once you have those parameters, it's, you know, how long is a piece of string? And I think we felt that we were being quite generous, but do you want to add on that? It's just a question of how much more. And we discussed, we had discussions with the judge as well, and we felt that 40% was a reasonable compromise. But do you...
We spoke with SARS in depth on that, and SARS, the officials there were very involved in the previous amnesty, and the 50% rate, the final effective rate after doing 50% was quite a lot higher than the previous amnesty. So, I mean, the feeling was, let's not keep it too high, because also it was a little bit high compared to international scenarios. But we didn't want to go as low as the previous amnesty because of this automatic exchange of information that is coming in. So we felt that we didn't need to try and be as accommodating as previously. And we think that that is still a bit of a threat for us, even though maybe they do think otherwise. And that was the general thinking. But it was based on SARS's expertise and going through the inquisitors.
Okay, Mr. Topham, can we turn to that one?
I'm interested in LPAN. If we were to have the same rate as the first time, what would the cure rate be then? 30%? The double now for the last one was 20%. The other one was
minimum, and if they want to store, they will store. Instead of them having a checkbox percent and then saying if you're not going to bring in questions into your assets, then it says nothing.
Can I also raise another thing? See, basically, it's a very mechanistic proposal, right? I mean, what the chair is supposed to do in a conversation like this, which is, isn't there some sort of compromise between what there is and some of the observations they need to make? It's a very crude mechanistic artificial proposal from me that I don't really know. And I'm not going to know. I mean, I'm going to take advice from them. And with due respect to Gloria and to Natalia also, as great as they are, they haven't got the experience and the people you could start with the lawyers and a team of experts outside of the department not being the judge. So, you know, my own literary inclination is to say that, you know, I'll keep it towards you, but on the other hand, I don't know. And if you confirm to it, you can make my life easier, but that doesn't mean that you decide along those lines. You consult with the family and try it, and you come back to it.
This is a judgment call, and it's really fairness over time. The more you drive it, for example, another industry, then people think the next one will be more generous.
Yeah.
So that's why you don't ever want to make it more generous than the previous one. It's also a function of if you're desperate for cash, then I guess you go down very low. Now, I don't believe we're desperate. And frankly, even in the trade, we have vibrant discussion. Why even have it? Let the people who can comply face the music.
Yeah.
And as you have the automatic exchange of information and so on, people are being pushed. So why, I think, my personal view is we should sit and wait. Okay? Because the world is getting tougher. Okay. I think that when we were here, Admiral Mayden himself made that point in a very strong way. The DPC has been very strong in going and talking to people, and yet it has generated expectations. When we've had meetings, you see it's really the representatives of the extremely wealthy. Now, to answer your question, how much has gone out? Who knows, but I agree with you. I'm sure a lot of very wealthy people, just to diversify their risk, would have taken aside from the fear that they would have.
Yeah.
The difficulty you face with that is by now most of those people, if they've taken their money out and gone out of the country, or often you find that their children are out of the country, the wealth has now gone perhaps down to the next generation. And so it's now so dispersed by now in some instances, and again, who knows, you know, how much. So it's a difficult call, but I think as people face pressure, we felt, you know, let's not be overly generous. And my problem with the discussion, and I think that the PBO is raising, is, you know, you start here. This is like a negotiation. Let people come and move down. If someone still comes and we move down, I think in this case, the person who submitted it will have been following this discussion. I think it's legitimate to ask him why come now. Okay. No, in this case, because this is a rate issue, it's not commenting on, you know. So I would say people just.
Did he take on rate?
I don't know. Let me tell you, he's done much more lobbying. Okay, it's gone everywhere.
Democracy.
Okay, and that's democracy. That's fine. I don't have an issue in Texas about
not
a lot of it is about lobbying. But my only question to you is why didn't you come early?
Yeah.
You know, when it's not a new issue. So, and that would be my approach on the rate issue. I think on the timing issue, we have extended, but we also
That's it. All right, totally guys. Now I don't know what we do actually. I'm teaching towards saying we agree with Treasury, but. Look, to be fair to everybody, we can keep the door open. Gloria, can you and Zulatani and I consult? Will you be able to come back with an opinion by tomorrow? You can't do anything. We'll have to. Okay, tentatively, you should come back with an opinion by 10 o'clock tomorrow. Yes, sir.
Chair, Leonard actually derived my general personal view of the matter is not the sympathy to the recruit exchange in we are going to go ahead, we need to structure it in a way that will work. Because frankly, we are desperate for revenue. I mean, the minister himself announced there'll be 13 billion rand of additional taxes levied in the next budget. So surely we need to structure the mechanism, including the inclusion rate, on some more objective evidence about what we think will work, despite our personal view that our personal objection to the mechanism. What worries me is that when one asks probing questions about how National Treasury arrived at the inclusion rate, it doesn't seem to be based on A, the criteria of what will work and give us the greatest yield, and B, it doesn't seem to be based on any objective criteria or step. But I would be interested in what PDO comes up with, and I would be very interested in what they find.
Do you reply? Chair, I think I've said this is a judgment call. So you know, that's why we have not put any amount in that discussion. The GTC is going around saying amounts. We are not putting out any amount. So we don't want to call on a number when we think it's really not possible to go general. Just on the other thing, I just spoke to Yanga. I think we are willing, just even given the passage, the time of the legislation, to go even later than June. And in fact, now this may be changing. October,
yes,
the
committee's
happy.
Well, let's do that.
So we can certainly change it.
I asked you earlier about something really annoying and I didn't want to.
So
please, he has a way of doing that. Don't you worry. I don't know much business to you. And I actually think.
Maybe you've got another book.
Yeah, of course. Don't you remind me. Actually, I want to repeat that stuff. Now, the thing is, look. I think just do it.
Okay.
I was going to say that it's not you're going to get a, it's going to be a headache for you, but if you can do it, let's have it. On this matter, look, personally speaking, I'm sympathetic to you, but I have to change. And Momo, I know that guy is going to change if I have income, but I don't get the issue. Fine. So we conclude on this note, right, if I'm correct. One is that we agree on extension. So we will have to make the amendment. And it's in the report. I'm in the report, right? Where's Antonio? It's not just help us. We put that in the report. Secondly, on this outstanding matter, if PBO can deliver by tomorrow, that means you have access to Momo or somebody in delegates to check things. So Momo, are you going to be accessible to all your delegates?
Yanga will be.
Yanga. Okay, between Yanga and you can do this. You can do it. Help sort that out. Thirdly, we say that, for what it's worth, personally, I'm sympathetic to the situation. First of all, the fact that, you know, people are saying it's a double objective measure, it's not a I understand what you're trying to do, that's your call. Then on the issue of what VA is presented here, I read this thing. I will look at it more carefully. I can't see anything here that really good with the ANC, but people can look at it outside the meeting. So, like Momo is suggesting, it goes into the administration.
Yes.
You guys are fine with that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure why it needs to go there, an amendment to one or other bill. Is there a legal requirement that it shouldn't be there?
Yeah, remember, firstly, now we're dealing with two sets of bills, right? So the monthly special also has two, right? The one that deals with the actual rate and the one that deals with the administrative ratio. So especially given that it's the VDP, there are lots of administrative issues, so that's why we've had to have the second bill. If we had only dealt with dates, we didn't need the second bill.
So all the issues on reporting and so on, if you put it into the evidence book, it's still, you want to, but let the lawyer.
May I interrupt? Are we happy?
I may agree. Only other thing is a trivial one. I don't know what the, I think the only thing is the shallow. After 9 years in March, right? But you can do the verse of the thing. Then a minor thing. Right? Where's Fright, by the way? Is that,
contains changes to leadership, incentives, and implementation.
and that characterizes us especially in curriculum finance level two part. And we received comments from 17 organizations specifically on leadership and employment expectations. Oral presentations were made to the SOL. During the oral presentation on 9 November, the same task group also made oral presentation on the health trend of long-term insurance due to the introduction of STEM. This issue was not contained in the second version of the national health in the first version of the today, National Trainer and Staff presents a draft recommendation to the Standing Committee on the summary of responses to the comments on ETI, learnership, and care treatment of long-term insurance due to the introduction of STEM.
About the learnership tax incentive. As I'm sure the committee is aware, we did a review this year. The incentive was to apply for learnership agreements that were entered into after 1 October 2016. That does mean that if you enter into a learnership agreement before 1 October 2016, you can still claim the deduction going forward, but you can't claim for any new learnership agreements entered into after 1 October 2016. The reason it's in the second T-Lab batch is because we haven't finished with our review yet before the first T-Lab went out. We completed that review, we put it on our website, so it was quite a lengthy document, but it goes into a lot of details on the numbers. And from that document and from the analysis we did, we decided that we do think it is beneficial. And it is helping individuals get training and for employers to help employees obtain training. And we felt that there should be an extension of the incentive for a further 5 years. It has been extended twice before for 5 years. But we did feel that there was a need for a differential rate in terms of the amount of the incentive. So for NQF levels 1 to 6, we increased the value of the incentive from 30 to 40, and for NQF levels 7 and up, we decreased it to 20. So just in terms of the comments, go to the next slide, just in terms of the comments that we received, and the first one, which was quite a large one, and I think in the public hearing it was made clear to the committee, that why can't this incentive be claimed for things other than learnership agreements and apprenticeships? What about internships? What about graduate programs? What about mentorships? That's the main comment. Our view is that we don't think that should be accepted. In the current framework, it's linked to the South African Qualification Authority certificate, the actual certificate that you can get, and it's easy at the start to verify that actual training has taken place and the individual has something that they can now take forward with them. So they can go to the next employer and say that I've got the certificate. So it's a quantifiable, it's a hard case of this is training that this person has received and should upskill them and make them more attractive for new employers. If we have internships or graduate programs, but internships and mentorships, it's very difficult to start to verify that. And we're not sure that if that individual goes to the next employer, whether they will actually be beneficial or not. So we didn't want to expand it to that extent. For graduate programs, those individuals who already say have got some training have already they've already benefited. The graduate programs we think isn't specifically targeted for those who are unskilled. So we didn't think that it should be extended to that extent. Okay, on the next comment, this was just some clarification. A lot of people were saying, which I said initially, what's going to happen with the current learnership agreements. This is to say those are all fine, nothing will change that, including the rate. So if you entered into a learnership agreement before 1 October 2016, the rate will remain at 50,000. Okay, and it will continue to be 50,000 regardless of whether you enter NQF 1 to 6 or enter NQF 7 and above.
Just for members, we've got both the slide and the document, the draft response document, which it provides more details. So this is just a
On that issue, how will, because we're now creating the split between the incentives, the value of the incentives between NQF 1 to 6 and 7 and above. There are some questions of, well, what will we do if somebody now gets a qualification halfway through their learnership agreement? SARS will simply, in our response, will pro-rata the value. So up until the month in which you have the qualification in 3F1-6, you will get 40,000. And then after that moment, when you now have an NPS 7 or 8, let's say, and you move forward, but you're still within the learnership agreement, it'll be prorated at 40,000 to a month going forward. SARS thinks that is fine, and we'll be able to accommodate that. The next comment that we received is on the actual differential in the rate. So in effect, we are decreasing the incentive value for NPF level 7 and above. So the comment is that, you know, if you have top training outside of public practice, that will now get a lower value. And the question was, that shouldn't be decreased, that should either be kept the same or it should be increased up to 40,000. Our response is, we are trying to make efficient use of public resources here, and we're trying to target the incentives as accurately as we can. We believe if you have a qualification level of NQS 7 or above, you have some skills available to you. You are attractive to employers. We don't believe that in steadily increasing value of the incentive should be given to these individuals if they already have some skills and if they are already attractive to employers. So this is in line with the Department of Higher Education and Training's view that the incentive should be more focused on the employees that will get the greatest benefit from the learning. And it also is in line, as we believe, with the National Development Plan that says to use 30,000 officers by 2030. So in this current equally constrained environment, and given the fact that we're trying to target our incentives to a great degree, we think it is justifiable to decrease the value for those on higher level. The next one is on teachers. We've got a lot of comments, and I think the community has also spoken quite a bit on this, and that teachers are one of the main stumbling blocks to be able to use this learnership incentive successfully. And that there's a lot of disparity between the teachers. Some teachers are working very well, and the industry players in that sector are very happy to keep them as they are, while others aren't. What that then means is that the incentive can be used to a greater extent in one sector and to a lesser extent in another. And can't National Treasury do something to change this? Part of the options that we considered and spoke about in the review, but also have been put forward to us, are that the learnership incentive should not be directly linked to a teacher alone, i.e. there should be space for private providers to put forward SAQA accredited qualification, and the incentive would be available for that as well. So in effect, you would go around the teacher. And this is something we're thinking about, and we've noted the comment there. Primarily rests with the Department of Higher Education and Training, which we have had some meetings with, but we are willing to engage further with them to discuss this further. But this is not something that we felt we could do at this stage. But the comment was appreciated. Okay, and then on to the employment tax incentives. So, like the learnership tax review, this was also part of the second batch. The review hadn't been completed, but also we were still engaging in NETAC with the other stakeholders in terms of what an agreement should be. I hope the committee has seen the NETAC report. The final NETAC report on this. So, from that review and that report, we felt that there was a sufficient justification for an extension of the incentive. By 2 years, it was agreed within the committee. We also proposed in the legislation and in there to a 20 million rand cap on the incentive per employer, so that they couldn't claim more than that. From the evidence that we had seen within the review, it was quite clear that smaller firms had a positive impact on employment, but it was slightly unclear at the larger size of firms whether there was additional employment. create a juicy incentive. And we felt, given the capital constraints as well, that a cap could be introduced in the draft legislation. In terms of the comments that we received, we had business enterprises, tax practitioners, payroll, and the Labour Federation opposing the proposed 20 million rand cap. They felt that this was an impediment to large-scale employment creation initiatives and an unnecessary administrative burden. So in our view, we've accepted that proposal. Because this is a bit different compared to previous responses, this isn't us accepting the proposal for a change. I assume this is us proposing to the standing committee for them to change since the bill was already in table. So we're proposing to the committee that the committee would accept that proposal of getting rid of the 20 million rand cap. We do believe that employment growth is a key aspect, obviously, of our policy, and we don't want to hamper that in any way. So the two options are either to increase the level or delete the cap. If we increase the level from the statistics we looked at, it would affect only a couple of firms. So rather than increasing the level, we felt that we should rather remove the cap. So that's our proposal, but we would still like to monitor the fiscal situation going forward, and if anything does change, we can relook at it including that.
We've also been engaging with the business and labor over what's called the YES initiative, which is the Youth Employment Service, where sort of business is coming with a proposal to see how they can create, in addition to what we have, something in the region of 350 to 500,000 jobs for young people. So in the light of that, we also felt this as a matter of debate. It would be good then just to leave out the cap, because it's in the interest of getting more employment. And in fact, I had spoken to the two players there who are leading the business group, it's Stephen Kosak and Colin Cove. And they were willing to come to Parliament to brief you on that initiative.
The next comment part of the cap was we had a range of alternative targeting suggestions that were provided to us. These included changing the eligible income band, changing the age range, also including other types of work with short-term work experience, and or perhaps changing the incentive for longer-term unemployed. At the moment, we haven't accepted those adjustments. I do know that the EA has put forward some of their own legislative amendments which related to this. But at the moment, we haven't accepted this, given that we think the targeting at the moment is good. If you look at the descriptive report that we provided on the website, you'll see that the majority of individuals who do claim this incentive are within the 2,000 to 4,000 rand income bracket, and it dips away as it goes to the higher levels of the income bracket. Also, if we believe that for individuals who are between the age of 18 and 29, if they are earning much of a higher salary than that, then they probably have skills and they probably have some attributes which will bode them well for the rest of their career. And we don't know if it could be an effective use of revenue resources in order to now provide an incentive for them if they were going to be employed, have a greater possibility of being employed in the future. And the other factor is just that it does have quite a large revenue implication if we were to change it. So if we change the eligibility criteria, it could bring in hundreds of thousands of additional individuals for the incentive. If we did that, we would really need to cost it and perhaps change the fiscal framework to develop implications on that. So we would need to think carefully about it and liaise with our fiscal policy unit and our budget office behind any of the changes of the those ranges. But we will, I mean, we can consider it and we can think about it for the future. We think it's greatly positive at the moment. On the last comment, second last comment on this guy was the One Labour Federation felt through the NELAC proceedings, and they just come here and present as well, that this should only be supported if we can exclude labour workers. Our view is that we haven't accepted that. In the tax system, we really would like to treat everybody equally based on specific characteristics. Obviously, there are some changes. We get additional rebates depending on your age. There are central incentives that we provide. But in terms of a labour broker, what we responded to the Labour Federation was that we really wanted to look for the causes of what labour broking, of what they were unhappy with about labour broking. So we wanted to really address the root cause. If you call yourself a labour broker, we don't feel that the tax system should change based on what or who you are. It should, if there was going to be a change, it should be based on some fundamental reason behind the change. Is there some type of labour practice that is unacceptable? Is there some other type of characteristic which we can draw on to exclude the incentive? So it wouldn't only, if that were the case, it wouldn't only impact on labour brokers, it might impact on others, but then there would be a justifiable basis for why you exclude the incentive for that particular type of behaviour. And that really is something that we would like to stick to, and we are trying to engage with them to find what exact characteristic they don't enjoy. But it must be said that the purview of labour relations really rests with the Department of Labour. I think we have assumed that for the public hearing and discussed that. And in this incentive, we're not trying to change the Labour Relations Act, we're not trying to change any other type of legislation relating to labour relations. And we would rather let it be dealt with through those measures. We can liaise with the Department of Labour, which we have been doing, to try and see what the negative, potential negative impacts of the incentive are, and we can address them directly. That's our view on labour practice. The next one is, there was a proposal for a 3-year extension. We did have some sympathy, or we did, I suppose, like the idea, but we noted it, but we would, at the moment, propose that the cost stays at a 2-year extension. We think 2 years would be a sufficient amount of time for further additional information, to also then review it again and assess and discuss and then back and try and get to the bottom of the impact of the incentive. It may also have some revenue implications if we do extend for another 3 years, but it is something that we did notice in the
Chair, I guess the issue is that it may have revenue implications beyond the fiscal framework. So that's why we didn't want to deal with the third year now. And also, if you go back to the earlier point that Chris made, there's a number of proposals on the age range, the band, etc. And we think that that's something that we could take up after the 2-year review. Because I think it's unlikely if this incentive is actually working, that we need to end it. So we're open to extending it, but then make a decision later.
The other one was on more regular quality impact evaluations are needed, ranging from assessing every 6 months to annual reviews. I do know that some of the committee members' proposals in the legislation have asked for actually writing up the information that would be required in the legislation to Parliament. We said partially accepted here. I mean, the current legislation says we need to report twice a year. We've been doing that really through budget review statements. And then we did publish a very long descriptive report that gave, we think, quite a large amount of information on the incentives. You know, we think that has been sufficient. Unlike the Special Voluntary Disclosure Program, we don't know if it's quite necessary to adjust the reporting requirements for this. you know, we commit to continue to being transparent on this. We'll make all our documents public, and then we would also like to include the monthly revenue loss to the EMP 201 forms that are selected in the Section 32 reports that are published monthly on our website, which we can do. But we're not sure if we think it's necessary to add those additional reporting requirements to the department.
Again, Chair, it's purely because we say that info for incentives are really infrequent. So it's hard enough, I think, to give sensible information more than when the large data is available, which is trying to collect. But the monthly information that we have, which is just the amount that's been expended, not the number of people, that we will actually publish as a matter of routine. So we can certainly do that. We will start doing that.
Sorry.
Another?
Sorry.
The next one is Ken.
Yeah.
In the 2015 TLF that was published at the first batch, the proposed changes to the classification of long-term insurance for the introduction of plans. In particular, the most important changes were the definition of business liability and the new definition of other services due to the fact that we follow the STEM and the exist in 2020. Because we are transitioning from the old order to the new order, it also introduced transitional rules that the transaction design can existing and early avoidance measures for calculating the transition amount. Because when we introduced the transitional rules, we did not want to have loopholes and then introduce the early avoidance measures as well. Although the same, the public hearings were held on the first batch, after the bill was introduced on during the MPB meeting, the 25th of October, the long-term insurers and the SEM came to Parliament on the 9th of November for the oral hearing. And in the Parliament, they requested that clarity on the proposed provision. So after the 9th, on the 14th of November, we called a meeting yesterday with all the insurers as well as the tech practitioner. And in that meeting, we provided our explanatory memorandum. And we must say that I can confirm, and Momo was in that meeting, and Johan from Canada, that after they read our explanatory memorandum, the interpretation was deferred. So now, after reading the interpretation, the explanatory memorandum, the interpretation was different, and then, but they said that we can meet to maybe in the 2017 tax legislation cycle to take away the inconsistencies, because the explanatory memorandum is clear. However, the bill may have some inconsistencies. And we requested to them yesterday, what, according to them, what is the proposed wording? They said they don't have at the moment the proposed wording. So we requested that they submit the proposed wording with the 2017 tax proposals and technical correction for the next year. And then we can have ample time to discuss the inconsistencies.
So Chair, if I may just come in, because I think this is because, one, we're still going to look at the insurance for the next year. So when it comes into effect, it's a function of that. Secondly, as SAM is being implemented, I mean, there are all these there's complexities because different companies operate differently. And with the new, IFRS 9. Okay. That all coming in, sort of companies are still figuring out how that's going to affect them. So there's no doubt that there will be issues that will flow over next year. And depending on how it affects their approach to this. And of course, what we don't want to do is, like with Basel III or with SAM, we are driving the regulatory changes. We don't want to just by that act change their tax liabilities and so on. It should be neutral. Having said that, however, of course, capital adequacy reserves increase, so that does change the path of taxation for them, because there's some element of the tax deduction and so on. So one sort of factor those things in, and then say, hopefully everybody is hit in an equitable way as we get more harmonization. So that is why they could not just sit and come up with better wording. They see the intention in the explanatory memo, but and remember, this issue did come up last year, and when you get to the end of the process, suddenly people find this complexity or that complexity. So we do feel we should go ahead, and then, of course, it's easier just to make amendments as they see what's already cast on the ground. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Mom. There were some areas whereby they said that the proposed wording in 29 Cap A 15 and 16 create potential risk to the fiscal. That those were their comments. But on explaining to them, you are of the view that the purpose of 29 A 16 and 29 A 15 is different, and the phasing in period that is intended to be 6 years. So we do not think that the wording creates potential risk. However, we said to them, as we are saying on the last slide, we note all the areas of concern, and we are willing to engage with them in the next cycle.
Okay, can I just get some guidance from the meeting? We both have to be fair, right? Understanding that you have to go, right? But there is a problem here, because you see, you are the guy that is in the public system. Hereby, obviously, that counselor to you as well. This meeting for his hour six, after Councilor Allison, who has been to the next moment, I told him, we can't slot him in time for the meeting for us, but we will have him after that. The date was decided at 4:32. The date has been changed. There's some confusion, which is very odd. Then I can talk about that. So it was changed. And then you came on as a head-on, because we now want to vote if possible on the 20th. Now, the thing is that if you look at the attendance today, entirely you might have to hear, I'm not sure, but that's not to say, that's got nothing to do with saying an exemption from the house. So, if we don't start with them now, it means they will have to come in after 2 o'clock. It's not fair on them. So, what I'm asking this meeting to consider is, we had a little discussion for 5 minutes or so. If we have Ilva, we give him a 2-hour slot. We have to squeeze it in 1 hour, 55 minutes. We have to go somewhere Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. And then after 2, we continue. That's one option. Let's see as we get to 1 o'clock. If people do not want to sit this afternoon, for whatever reason, I have nothing to do with me not being available, then we must accept ourselves from the house tomorrow. But we have to. But then the problem is, you people want to fly back. Yeah?
I'm here tomorrow because I'm attending the Cook of the Moon.
So you are here anyway. Yeah. And the rest of your team is being
so that you won't be there.
Yeah. So then we meet this afternoon because it can't be that the state will stay for you to stay one more night. So whether I'm here or not, either we will continue the meeting. Even if it's 2 people, it's not taking any decision. As far as I know, the DA is fine with it. And tell me, and I'll be here. I'm not here, but I'll be here. Right. So we are then going to continue. But for now, for 5 minutes, because we don't want to spend it. It's certainly more and more. I haven't really got the time that we save over here. Right. Over then to members. There are 2 procedural things I was very interested in about today. Did you have that meeting with Wittenberg? So we asked you to engage him.
Yes.
Oh, you have to do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we call them back and we do it.
Yeah. No, we will check.
Yeah.
But I think, and maybe it might be suggested, the issue of internship, just as touched on.
No, I know you did all of that, but matter of Parliament being seen to
yes.
be, not seen, but actually gay, but not have seen to,
yeah.
to be encouraging dialogue with NGOs, so these are do-gooders, unless there's something there we don't see. Because often people appear not even lying about them. And then we discover, hey, there's a whole lot of issues here. Now, somebody was very good and said, hey, aren't you getting all these support subsidies from agriculture and culture? So basically, we're not saying we want you to do what they want you to do. We are saying, actually, I'm quite sympathetic to what you say, even if all of us are sympathetic to the case. We can't leave them hanging in the air. If we can't deliver to them, in our report we must say, this is the reason clearly why we can't deliver, but this is the proposal we have, because we are sympathetic to them. Then we must write to the Minister of Agriculture and Land or whatever. We must actually encourage dialogue between them and the relevant department. We must write to the chairperson of the committee and say, look,
that it falls under UN sector. We have these people who appear in public hearings, make submissions to their own parliament. This parliament is about them, not us, either you or us. And then we leave them hanging and they say, oh, it doesn't affect us. Which you might be interested to know, we've listened to Yvonne Pinky Paul with all the NGOs last week who came to us when they should have gone there. Indeed, they did go there as we recommended. That's when we do our job. So in short, you have to meet them.
Yes.
We won't vote on the bill unless you've done so in the report.
We'll do that before you vote on the bill. I think the issue, remember, like you say, was that it involves other departments like higher education and so on. And from the day when we were Wednesday, there hasn't been enough time
to
let me just say, we actually very sympathetic to the issue.
No,
and I think
I don't
know
what
it
is, but I don't think it's correct.
Okay.
But there must have been sympathetic. But we've got to offer them some other alternatives. Because an emerging farmers project is a big thing, as you well know. So, having said that, the next thing then is the issue of bringing Coleman and his colleague here. Personally, I'm not over convinced we need to do that at this stage, but if the members of the majority want to do that, think about it. We'll have to take this and do that quickly. They'll have to appear sometime next week. He's a very busy man, General. We'll have to pin him down, right? There was a third issue. Can somebody help me now? What was the third issue? We said, can we invite the beneficiaries, right? And so on. And I said, how are you going to do that? I don't know, that's still hanging in there. Until somebody comes with a concrete proposal, I haven't got the energy, temperament, time, or ability to work out how you do it, right? And you referred us to the surveys. I am saying national treasury is being reasonable, right, in the circumstances. So it's the MPs to prove otherwise and do it now, this afternoon, if you have proposals, and then we take it forward. Momo, what time do you have to leave?
I'll stay here till about 3:00.
Yeah, but you won't be here this afternoon, right? The rest of your team will be here
at
2. Right, good. Thank you very much. Or 2:15, as we've agreed. We're going to the House for the first 15 minutes. Right, now over to the members.
Just for clarity, Chris, in terms of what we proposed for reporting on the EC, is it not correct to say that the National Treasury hasn't been very good about meeting the existing reporting requirements? Have reports been done in terms of what's already in the EC? Because you talked about reporting at budget time, I think. So that's the one question. And then, have you looked at what we're asking for? Is it covered in what's already there, or is there stuff that you think is at the moment is difficult to be able to do as we're asking? So a little bit more information on if you've looked it up, but I'm not sure what's waiting. And then, in terms of the SAM. You put them an hour and
something.
Yeah. In terms of the thing, I really am very badly informed about this. So please forgive me if I ask. I always ask you questions of chat. But what is happening is that we're doing these changes, but they have no real impact until later. And therefore, there's time to have a second look at them. Thank you.
Okay, the time is coming.
Chair, it's not a question. It's an issue that I want to look at first. The amount that we're giving to the people on NPF level 7, I want us to consult the HEC to see how we can resolve the remaining challenge of funding and see currently involved. Because I know that the reason why you're depressing is the fact that you're trying to look at the interest of the system. But we look at something else, we look at a very important skill that needs to be funded. So if that's not federal funding, we can maybe rope in other government departments to build on that incentive. So I would have wanted us to pass that specific one for a later consultancy as part of the recommendation, so that we revisit how this incentive can be empowered. In particular, by the citizens making a specific contribution, it might not affect the current cycle of budgeting, but moving forward, it might change if we agree in principle on how there can be a shared responsibility to national Kenya and the citizens. Because remember, we've said this is a critical thing, and the reality is that the very same people that we think are better off, they are not, in terms of funding their own institutions. So they need to be funded, and we need that. So we need to make, even if it's funding resources stumble, but I would want us to pack it, and then we come with a resolution that we can do. So I don't know.
I
don't
know
if they're
packing the sense that the next meeting we have a little bit of a problem. Yeah. And there are Tanya, you might be interested to know that when the committee heard that you had a plan, when the committee heard that you had a plan, the entire committee just
started to say, are they here?
And stopped the meeting and for us all to go rescue.
No, I should have brought the new one.
And then somebody said, no, we don't know exactly where you are. I thought it was a little bit insane. No other member in the entire parliament.
Okay. Thank you, Brandy. That was you, I hope.
Secondly, can you just minute that I got this from Mandy to buy it? Robin, what you're saying is that we unanimously agreed that we would use find a friend from in future so we could identify that. Okay. 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 Okay, over to you, Mr. Cuffin.
Thank you, Chair. Just 2 points. One that I'd like to note. The storm Chris has said sexually intended in the take now. We're only going to be studying.
Oh, very good.
I'm on the leadership. On the leadership back in the center and reducing the amount of NPM level 7 and up. I think the intention behind the leadership is to actually make it worthwhile for employers to give this practical training to employees. Because everybody knows, if every employee is an article clock, they don't make any money. So by giving this incentive for a higher level of qualification, this is a good degree, doesn't mean they're employable. And that's what makes it, for instance, CA, that's employable, is that experience they get on. So I don't think it's a big issue, but the principle behind it, there should really not be a difference with you. Training at the tunnel or the CA, the one will make more money in the long run, the tunnel. The company employing you is going to lose money for at least 2 years or 3 years because of the amount of work you've got to spend training your person under which. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who's
that?
Yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, just to come back to the reporting of requirements, the difficulty with the Principal Act is that Level 2, it's not easy to list the finance and publish information on the employment tax incentive twice a year. The difficulty with that is that it doesn't specify what information must be published by the Minister, and the information that is published by the Minister is not taken in Parliament. So the defect which I think we need to deal with is to specify what reasonable information should be made available by the principal. And of course that is constrained by what data can reasonably be collected. And our proposal might be deficient in that respect. But then to strengthen and say the information that the person published must also be taken into account. Right, next, Gloria.
Thank you, Chair. I just have left three questions. I think the biggest one for me is there's a lot of uncertainty, or at least there's no definitive answer in terms of the effectiveness of the incentive. And the biggest issue there has been the inefficiencies around the data set and the exchange of data cleaning as disclosed for the preliminary report. Now my question is, I don't really hear anything around the changes on data collection.
for this upcoming period. Now, what is going to be different than the past year? How then will you be able to report better in real time, given the inadequacy data? And then you spoke about the skill level and the uptake being mostly between the 2,000 and 4,000 range. Could that not be because that is the range that the employers benefit most in terms of the incentive? And then lastly, are the specific points in time and specific trends in terms of how you're going to evaluate the effectiveness of the incentives? And I think this goes not just on for the two incentives, but it's important that when incentives are put in place, there ought to be clear trends on the evaluation of the effectiveness.
Let me just answer broadly. I mean, I think, and let me start with the last one. I think we agree fully that we want all incentives to be examined much more for their effectiveness, and to get more reporting on them. In fact, it's a proposal we've put in the terms of reference of the Davis Tax Committee, and they haven't yet done the report on those. But again, just getting to the complexity, and I know I'm sorry to repeat this, but the problem with any tax incentive is that we only get information once people have filed their final tax submissions, or filled in certain forms, which is what the EMP 501, which is the, yeah, okay, Chris will give you those details. And then it still takes a long time before SARS can process that and give it to us. So even when the year has finished, it takes us many months before the tax year is over, before SARS can actually submit it to us. And that is really we found the only reliable info. Initially we thought there was also a media report that SARS gets, but employers actually don't fill in that field. Not an obligation. So therefore, I mean, the info was frankly useless. So, you know, we can publish it, but it will be rubbish. The only other one that we get is a monthly return where people show their deduction. And that is what comes through. So if you look at the questions that you ask, in the study that we've published, we are able to say number of people who have taken up, what the total amounts are, so it's easy to determine average from that. But to say who's been rejected, nobody gets rejected except when someone submits and they give the incentive, they claim the incentive for a 31-year-old. Then obviously it will be thrown out. Because this is the employer deciding who they're going to get and for whom they qualify. But Captain, I don't know if you want to come in on more on the data issue. So in terms of reporting, that's why I think we're saying that we can certainly provide the report when we get the detailed info, and we can provide the monthly info that we get. So what it needs to check is that when we have another 2 years, we will firstly only get the current year's info and maybe the first year's info in time. We won't have the second year's info when we do the next review. So that's why we'll be able to better assess it, because we'll have more than 1 year's of solid data.
I don't want National Treasury to pull themselves beyond what they are capable of doing, especially when they're giving data on the first year, because you see this is a debatable net. And I'm going to make a suggestion which I believe will cover even the perception that there's rejection. How do you wait for a 2-year report where the entire internship is reported upon. And then it will give satisfaction to the DA on those who qualify for the college, and in an event that there's been a mishap in relation to those who might have not qualified, you will entertain that matter as a fact. I think you catch the point. So that you give a consistent data, because if you only give for the first year, there will be omission for the second year, and probably the employers might have not claimed for both the 2 years. They might want to claim for both the years in the second year and not just submitted in the first year. So the data that we'll be providing will not be accurate. So I don't think there should be a rush in provision of the data, but to look at the impact in its totality at the end of the incentive itself. Unless there's a particular issue that you guys have identified that you can put on the table and we look at. Because it might be an unintended consequence of the incentive itself. It might not be a restrictive clause within how the incentive has been formulated. I don't know if you catch me, Chair. I didn't want to drag it, but I wanted to make it.
Can I just say something, Mr. Lee? Can we talk about, I'm very worried about IR today. It's just wrong what it's happening today, right? So it's very mechanical and artificial, but it's going to be a mechanical kind of point. Now, nothing stops people from pursuing the thing up to win. The more you want to hear that stuff. So, okay. Geology, Mr. Lee, let me join your approach.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to pursue the opportunity.
Right, so we start with you, though. Thank you.
Yeah, so, and this
time, okay, can we go over to IRBA, please? We've got an hour and a half. You're not going to be part of our budget. Which we're going to do, we're coming to you. We're going to tackle this challenge. What we're doing, because of the number of entities that fall. So, what we do is every year we cycle, alternate, we look at the report formally and then we report tomorrow. So this is not as rigorous and as changeless as you do on the annual report as what happens when you are part of the cycle. So why don't we agree on this report that they will be next year part of the 3 years that we look at? In the fourth quarter, in late third quarter, early fourth quarter. So given that that is the case, I'd like to structure the meeting. Before you just speak to your position that you approached me about, and I said report to the committee, on the rotation of auditors, right? There's been a lot of public comments about it. It's consistent to a lot of it is what we want as a committee, that the big four don't dominate, and so on and so on. Now, I know it's controversial, and it invariably is if you transform it, right? So, we're more interested in that. Having said that, can I suggest then that we've got an hour and a half of time to know that you structure the time such that you speak for about 20 minutes or so on the annual report, and then 25 minutes or so, or up to 25 minutes or so, on the latest proposal you've got to give you a greater representativity in the auditing thing. Thank you very much for watching. Often confusion about the role of the RBA as reported to 18 like this.
And for example, an organization like the African Institute of Chartered Accountants, which is a membership body. The RBA is not a membership body, it is a audit regulator, and our responsibility is to protect the public. I also just want to remind the committee what our objectives are. Take you through some of the highlights of the RBA for the last year. And then I will cover very briefly the financial statements and report of the Auditor General. And then we won't take you through all the performance information because for all three aspects, the financial information, compliance and performance information, the RBA sees a clean audit report every year. So you don't need to spend too much time on that. The key focus of the RBA, as I mentioned, is to protect the financial interests of the public by ensuring that only suitably qualified individuals are admitted to the audit profession. The previous discussion from Momo dealt with competencies of chartered accountants, but even more importantly, when you go into the area of auditing, you have to be a chartered accountant, but it's even more important that you are qualified and competent. And we have to ensure that those people that perform that public service of auditing on which the public relies, that they are competent enough to do so. So it's our responsibility to ensure that only competent people enter the profession, and then after they enter, that they deliver audit quality services or services of the highest audit quality, and that they have to comply with the highest ethical standards. And that links into my next presentation on mandatory audit firm rotation. Our objectives then, specifically as set out in our Auditing Profession Act, is to develop and maintain audit standards. And our Act specifically says that it has to be internationally comparable. So we've adopted, earlier you talked about IFRS, we don't regulate the accounting standards, only the auditing standards. So we've adopted the international standards on auditing in 2005, and we've also adopted the International Code of Ethics, except that as a regulator, our code is a lot more stringent than the International Code for Ethics. We provide a framework for the education and training of properly qualified auditors. And you might recall that up to last year, the RBA set part two of the board exam before qualifying as a chartered accountant. That exam is now moved back to the institute. But what the RBA has introduced is what we call the Audit Development Program. And in terms of that program, when you become an auditor, you have to spend 18 more months at the audit firm to ensure that you've obtained the practical competencies to be able to audit. So our responsibility is still to create that framework for becoming a qualified auditor. We register auditors. We have about 4,500 auditors in our register. We also monitor compliance with a reportable irregularity. It's a very important section in our Act that requires auditors to report any irregularities to the RBA. And of course, we are a supervisory body at the moment in terms of the Financial Intelligence Center Act. So we also monitor auditors' compliance with anti-money laundering requirements. Auditors have to report certain wrongdoings. When we issue the auditing and ethics standards, we also have to ensure that auditors comply with those standards, and we monitor that compliance by performing inspections. One of the few professions that perform inspections on their own registrars. And we've got an inspections team of about 12. We go around and we perform inspections on auditors. And if there is any referral from inspections on auditors not complying with the standards, then they get referred for investigation. It might end up in disciplinary action against that auditor. Of course, any member of the public can report an auditor to the RBA and we will start an investigation. Or if we're aware of any wrongdoing or potential or possible wrongdoing from an auditor, the RBA can start its own process to investigate that auditor. But those are the objectives that set out in our legislation. Just a few highlights in our annual report. This year we celebrated 10 years of independent audit regulation. Up to 2006, we were a regulator, but pretty much, if I'm allowed to use this word, I'm not sure, captured by the profession. Thank you, Chair, for the indulgence. After 2006, a big part of our mandate was to become independent as a regulator. And I'll talk about that when I talk about mandatory audit firm rotation. But 10 years of independent audit regulation, and during that process we have graduated up to a point last year where the board of the RBA is completely independent of the profession. There are no practicing auditors on the board, although they are all highly qualified individuals that are chartered accountants. We achieved the first position for our auditing standards in the World Economic Forum's last global competitive ranking. That was for 7 consecutive years. The RBA issued its first public inspections report titled Striving for Consistent and Sustainable High Audit Quality, in which we make public the inspection's findings. We don't name the audit firms yet, but we do make public the findings that we come across during our inspections. We introduced the audit development program, which I referred to earlier, which is the new way of ensuring that auditors have the practical competencies to be able to audit in the current environment. As a regulator, as a public entity, we're one of the few that issued our third integrated report. There's no framework for integrated reports for public entities, but we have issued ours as our third report. We started a project to research how we can strengthen auditor independence, and that is why I'll be talking to you about mandatory audit firm rotation. And we conducted a survey to see why the audit profession is not as attractive as it was in the past to young professionals. Also to find out why there's not transformation in the profession, and why young professionals do not stay in the profession. So we're in the process of distilling those the results of that research. So those are our highlights. Chair, I'll then hand over to Wilhelmina to take you quickly through the financial statements and the performance information.
Thank you, Chair. On the financial floor, really then further highlight certain items. If we look then at summary of our financial performance, I think the main thing which we can look at there is really the drop in the revenue which we get under government grant. That was when government was saying there's no money, and that was a very big limitation on us. So that has from one year to another 1.5 million rand. Then we had other income was then also cut, mainly due to the exams which we did for qualified auditors move over to SPICA, so we did not have that income anymore. But it had consequence also on the expenses. On our expenses, you will see it only went up actually by 4 million, which is only 4%, which is really where the RBA has tried their best to do cost containment, while government cut our costs. But the biggest challenge we had is that due to the ROS report, which you have heard before, is that we have to strengthen our inspections and our investigations department. So in that, our employment costs actually have to increase because we developed a different separate investigations department and then also strengthening our inspections department. Due to that, actually our staff cost, which is more than 70% amount of our cost, went up by 8 million rand. And we have to save on other costs. Then the other impact, if you then see in total, we went from a surplus 7.4 million rand, already saving money and starting getting the new employees, which was only employed in the next year, to a deficit of 3 million. In the year of 2015, when we had the surplus, as the Act says, public entities is not allowed to keep accumulated reserves, we had to surrender 2.7 million to Treasury. On the year thereafter, so they do cut us by 5 million and anything we say, we have to keep that. That has an impact now obviously on the next year. We have then been able to...
Those are not clever auditors, do
they? So we have then asked Treasury that says, please, you have cut us, we have to strengthen our independence with investigations and inspections, so although we then still have accumulated reserves, we did not return any or surrender any reserves in the next year. So we do have some surplus which we built up over the years, and we've asked them now, but in our forecast, that will be really in 3 years' time, we will have used up all those on the condition that Treasury doesn't take back more. So then just to look at more deep in our income stream,
Just to explain a little our business, as we first say, government grants drop nearly by 13%. While they still say we must strengthen our inspections and investigations, we then really have uncontrollable fees. What I mean by that is like our disciplinary fines. It all depends on what cases come through. It's very ad hoc cases, and the board has taken a decision to really recover more of the cost and penalize the auditors which don't perform. So in our additional process, last year we got more income, but that also relates to more lawyers' costs. The exam fees, as I already said, we don't have that anymore, but it was also a saving in our cost. And the MBE, which Mr. Honker will talk about, which we don't do anymore, and it was already dropping last year. Then you will then see, for us to recover, we really recover more fees from the auditors on inspection fees, 10% more, and also on the monitoring fees. But on our firm fees, it was also a higher increase, but due to the drop of the number of auditors, there was only a net impact of 5.9%. And then our trading contracts was sort of an accounting thing from SIPO, when less trading contracts come through that year, which also means we have some income. So that is really that our income, partly government, then a part which we can't control, it all depends on events, and the rest is what we can control. And just to mention, for our current year, because government grants are still low, we actually increased the fees from auditors by 14%, which is a heavy impact on our current financial year, but that's the only way we can really deliver on our mandate. So then, just to say that the report from the Auditor General for the year ended 2016 was a clean audit report, also for 7 consecutive years, so it was clean. It's only a South Africa concept, the clean audit award, which means that the financials were unqualified and they were all our predetermined objectives and compliance were all adhered to, and also internal controls. No concerns there as by the Auditor General. I think that is what you expect from the regulator auditor, so we will try our best not to break that record ever. I think on the performance, really, we then don't have to talk further. We did achieve all our objectives except the one which we had to change, and that's the ADP program, but it was really just all 100% achieved on auditing and ethical standards. All the projects was achieved. We can maybe quickly go through the other objectives. The education, the one, as we say, it changed, but the monitoring reports, we achieved 100%, doing what you need to do. Inspections, we did, 93% was achieved, so we had to achieve 90%. Then after that, investigations, we had to complete 80% within 18 months, we did 92%, so that we achieved, and we achieved the clean audit report. So that is actually just a summary in short of that.
Good. Well, let's see what goes with your mindset, because
Chairman, good afternoon. My name is Imran. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today. With your time is very valuable, and it's a shame to talk to you. To share some thoughts about the accreditation ministry in South Africa. I prepared just two slides, and with a lot of interesting numbers on them, some very interesting numbers that you may be mentioned to other people after our meeting. Generally, the DE ministry in South Africa started a few years ago with people asking the question, so how empowered are you as a business? How do we know how black hole you are, and what are you doing for the sake of your empowerment credentials? And someone said, well, it would be a good idea if we gave every business in the country a score. If I gave them a score of 2, then I know a business with a 2 is better than a 3. And then someone said, well, if we're going to give everyone a score, how do we know whether those scores are going to be correct or not? And so they said, well, let's ask the auditors to check it. And so that's how the verification history came into being. And then they asked, well, if we're going to get the auditors to check it, we better ask Erbach to help. And so that's how Erbach got involved in the industry. Not something that necessarily came to us from Treasury, but came to us from the Department of Trade and Industry. At that time, many businesses, most businesses in the country needed to get certificates, and there was a need and opportunity for some auditors to get involved here, and approximately 300 auditors registered with us for this purpose, so that they would be able to give BE certificates. The important thing that happened is on the 1st of May last year, the rules of the game changed. The ministry, in this case DTI, decided that actually some of the certification work was burdensome for certain kinds of businesses. Let's take a different approach to it. And the different approach they took was that if you are a business whose turnover is less than 10 million rand, actually we're going to make this very easy. You don't need to go to an auditor anymore. Get an affidavit that says you are have a turnover less than 10 million rand, and you could either get a level 1, a level 2, or a level 4 BE certificate. Nice and easy. If you need a certificate on the turn for a tender, you could just do an affidavit that says so. But of course, if you're also a little bit bigger business, you're a business with a 50 million rand turnover, you're known as a qualifying enterprise, there too, there were some streamlined rules introduced, and only for large businesses, businesses for over 50 million rand, did the legislation retain the requirements for a certificate. What this meant is that the business of some auditors changed overnight. Some auditors who specialize in doing lots and lots of certificates, all of a sudden they didn't have to do any certificates. This, together with several other things that were changing in the industry, led the IRBA board to think about how do we continue to be involved here, what is the future going to look like. Fortunately, when the DTI introduced this, they introduced two bodies in the country, both the IRBA and the agency that sits within DTI called STANAC, as being bodies that could accredit auditors of very high and audit people. The IRBA board decided that in light of the changes that were happening in the industry, two sets of rules, two sets of bodies doing this, and an indication by DTI that at some point in the near future, they were going to replace the two of us with just one body in order to do this work. The IRBA board that would be proactive for us to stick to what we know best, and that's the regulation of auditors in the areas where they regularly do their work, let us withdraw from the industry. So on the 1st of October this year, after having given lots of notice to the marketplace, we withdrew from the industry. It means two or three things. It means that we don't charge the auditors a fee in order to do this work. It means that we do not have any guidance out there in the marketplace. And we say to them, you should not be signing such certificates anymore. Leave it only to those who are registered with STANAC. And if you would like to register with STANAC, by all means, go and register with STANAC to be able to do this. And this new dispensation is already in place. And there's a short transition period allowed now until the end of the year. Auditors have already started their work in April this year, so that they can finish their work. This is how the market has changed. So to put that into context, there were about 300 registered with us. About only 100 of them were actually active. You know, 300 came to see, only 100 were actually issuing the certificate. This is a relatively small industry, and among them, not all will move to STANAC because the business was not viable for many of them anymore. And so now the benefit for the marketplace is that there's now only one accredited issuer. There is no longer the confusion that there's a STANAC certificate out there or a Urban certificate out there with the potential for people shopping around for different scores. Now there's just one set of scores, a consistent approach in the marketplace. Chairman, the brief we received was that we should also speak a little bit about empowerment, and so we prepared just a single slide about transformation and the IRBA. One of the IRBA strategic pillars is about the transformation of the industry in the IRBA, and I thought that putting up these statistics is always a useful dipstick to take. And that is, how big is the CA profession in South Africa? The CA profession is approximately now 40,000 chartered accountants. That number changes by 2,000 every 6 months, every time there's an exam, about 2,000 people pass. So it's about 40,000 CAs in South Africa. And most recently, about 26% of them are black. About 26% of them are black. So that's about 10,000 of the 40,000 CAs are black. As you know, we draw auditors from the whole community of CAs.
Are we raising this before? Black is in the collective sense of people of color.
Yes,
but sometimes many times it's necessary to break it down. Because what we are finding with yourself is that Africans in so-called color are underrepresented. Indians are overrepresented. For historical and other reasons. And we know in this house
in many of the committees in, I think, 10 years ago, we stopped. Collectively, in terms of the law, all people of color are black. But it can be misleading in certain circumstances. So I think we said this to you about we want to know how many African and people of color. We don't know the race, but we have to be demographically representative. We are something we need to achieve also. This by itself is representation of politics. Look, I am not implying anything about integrity or contribution. You're all South Africans, you don't have to apologize for skin color, you don't have to get intimidated by your brown skin or white skin. You're South African. And if you do good, that's what ultimately people like me are comfortable with.
And you look at me when you say this.
There are people in Afghanistan who do the most horrific things, who make claims. There are non-Africans who are in the prison, right? Who are marginalized. I know all of that, right? I'm a marginalized. You don't know about it. I'm not apologetic about it. But here I'm an ANC National Democrat as the chair of the committee. And in terms of the National Democratic movement that we represent, this is an issue. So, in short, I don't even need to get attention. You'll answer that question in the report. I mean, listen, if only breaking down in African interests of your colors.
So, generalizing is an important question, and that other that he made is one that the industry puts out frequently and makes available in a live way. And one that is the respect of black African industry, the rate of change is faster than all other races. And of course the signature program there, the Tutuka program is an exemplar to other professions about the number of black African students that are being entering the profession through that route. However, a subsection of the 40,000 is the RA community, the community from which we draw that. I'll give you those statistics when we are about to read the book. And that is to say that IRB registrar, those who have a license on us to practice as auditors, reflect broadly the community from which we draw them. So approximately 24% of them are also black. And the number they're looking for, we're talking about 4,000. There are only 4,000 approximately in South Africa. The number varies from month to month, but about 10% of all teams in South Africa are in. However, what I've introduced in the community is a new category, CRA, something you may not have heard of before. And this is the candidate registered auditor in the BIRB. So this is now the first round of the BIRB. Because the act is now in effect for a year, registration started this year. This is the pattern of registration that we've seen. This only represents approximately 150 people who've registered with us so far. What these are is that probably with 18 months of registration, having accumulated a decent set of evidence, we will admit the license as auditors. And those statistics continue to reflect the overall trend. 28% is not much better than 24%, 26%. Of course, we recognize that that was not the primary objective of the auditor development program. Chairman, alongside it, though, is how is the whole industry evolving? This is actually where IRB plays a really important part. And that is the CA Charter statistics. At the level of just generic charter businesses, we needed to have aim for a ownership level of 20%. The profession, though, was aiming for an ownership percentage of 32.5%. Under the old charter, under the new charter, 32.5% remains under discussion. We don't know where they will finalize the discussion, but that's 32.5% versus the generic of approximately 25%. We've also drawn from the annual report what IRBA's own statistics are. IRBA's own statistics is that approximately 57% of our staff in a largely professional environment, a large number of chartered accountants and some lawyers, is 57% black and 43% white. And I also shared in the big blue block some idea of the IRBA initiative. The IRBA initiative that support transformation, both at the board level, the ADT being the signature, but the three levels of things, supporting learners in school, supporting students at university, supporting trainees while they are in the firm, trying to attract them all to become auditors, recognizing how many other things that they are competing with. I'll make those regular visits to the main motion.
Thank you, Imran Romina Chedu. Then pause there for questions on the annual report and the EE. And then I'll start with the national work conversation.
And why don't you do all of this? They need to relate to the system of the EE, communication and the rotation. Because the question is linked to that model, representation, the problem is the
Chair, maybe it isn't a bad time for us to present this to you because we're in the middle of a second consultation period, and I think a press release at this stage would actually be perfect. So I think the timing is not too bad. I start off with the RBA's four-pillar strategy which we presented in Parliament, and our four-pillar strategy, in addition to the mandate that I referred to earlier, includes four other pillars. The board had agreed on these pillars about 2 or 3 years ago in a five-year strategy.
The first pillar
is comprehensive regulation, and that is because the World Bank, what Amina referred earlier to, the report on the observational standards and codes, the ROSC, that the World Bank issued, they require South Africa to regulate not only auditors but all accountants. So not just the 4,500 auditors but 60,000 accountants, CAs and other accountants in South Africa. And we believe that that would be a very useful process because at this stage 4,500 accountants are registered, are regulated. That's only the auditors. While all other accountants, tax practitioners, consultants, there's no regulation. Forensic auditors, there's no regulation of those. Our mandate is only to regulate auditors. So what is meant by the comprehensive regulation is that all accountants or those providing financial services should be regulated by somebody. And we made a proposal to the Minister of Finance to take this upon ourselves. We've been regulating for 60 years and to regulate more people wouldn't mean that we have to increase our number of staff, it would just mean that we have to change our mandate. So the comprehensive regulation to us is important, and if something does go wrong in a financial crisis, we recognize that it's not always just the auditors that should be looked at, but also role players like the financial director, the audit committees, and the internal auditors. There's a whole host of stakeholders that should be involved, and if you regulate all of them, and if it's under one body, then at least if there's any systemic failure in the country, then we can deal with it in the appropriate way. The second pillar is independence, and the reason I put this up is because the independence pillar refers to two types of independence. First of all, the independence of the IRBA from the profession. I won't talk about that now. The second one is the independence of auditors from their clients. That is what manager audit firm rotation is about, and that is what I was talking about. The third pillar is transformation. Again, what we're trying to address with manager audit firm rotation is not something that we just come up with. It addresses two pillars directly, the independence pillar and the transformation pillar. And the last one is that we want to also, if we're doing so well in South Africa, we believe that we also have a role to support Africa. We don't have a budget and it's not in our mandate, and therefore we have to look at initiatives where we can support other African countries to get to the same level where we are without having to spend any money on it. So, Chair, what we're doing is not something that we've just decided on, it is directly linked to the strategy of the RBA. Now again, as I mentioned earlier, the role of audit and assurance is quite an important one, and it's not always direct or easy to make the link between the role of auditing, the role of regulation, and the role of assurance in a country and its financial markets. And this sums it up. It says that if we can promote integrity in financial reporting and building a basis to provide confidence to investors, auditors can reduce financing costs and ultimately contribute to the efficiency of our capital markets, which promote economic growth. All that really says is that if investors have confidence in South Africa's financial markets, then they will invest in the country, create employment and grow the economy. But to be able to have that confidence in the financial statements that auditors sign off on, it means that we have to have high quality auditing standards, high quality profession, and a regulator that is robust enough to pick up if that standard is not maintained. And that is really the role of the RBA and the profession. I referred earlier in our annual report to our number one ranking, and again, if you look at the people that object to mandatory audit firm rotation, one of the arguments is that if you've been number one in the world for 7 years, why are we doing something that might upset that? And let me explain what this ranking means. This ranking doesn't mean that we have high quality auditors out there specifically. Right? There are problems, and the failure rates from our inspections are huge and increasing. So this ranking doesn't refer directly to the quality of audit. It refers to the process that the RBA follows when it issues auditing standards. It's a very thorough due process. But on top of that, you have to inspect compliance to those standards and take action if there are no compliance with the standard. And that is what gives our standard setting the robustness. That is how the World Economic Forum explains this. So when the argument is used that we've got an excellent profession, that is not a valid argument. The argument is that we set standards and we monitor compliance with those standards. Again, we referred earlier to the recommendations from the World Bank. Yes, the World Bank in 2013 made 10 very important recommendations. Two of them were to strengthen the RBA's investigations process, inspections process, and that was to make us an even more robust regulator. And that is also why it's important that what we're doing at the moment to strengthen our regulation through introduction of mandatory audit implementation is not just something that comes from our four pillars, it also comes from the World Bank report. Now, as the chairman mentioned earlier, there's been a concern for a while that our market is dominated by a certain group of firms. And as a public entity, our objective is also to create access to others to the market. And at this stage, that access is not possible. I'm going to talk a little bit about audit failures. There's been quite a few audit failures globally and in South Africa. And we have to look, these are the kinds of things that worry us as a regulator. Because the less competition we have in the market, of course, the less quality we will have. Competition increases quality. And with the audit failures, our concern is that should one of the big four firms fail, then clearly we'll be left with the big three. And remember, it started with the big eight. And as the firms that the public relies on or investors rely on become smaller, the quality will drop. The competition is less. So we are concerned that should there be another audit failure of a big audit firm, then like with Arthur Andersen, for example, then we'll be left with three big firms. I'll share with you some fines paid by audit firms recently just to demonstrate that our concern doesn't arise from nothing. There's been a lot of cases against firms. I'll give you those stats in a minute. And also, not only the cases against the firms, but the huge fines payable by those firms. Now, we're not saying that those fines will break the firm completely, because these firms are huge, but the fines are increasing, and we need to be concerned about that. It's also not fair for the RBA to wait until something happens before they do something, and that's why we've been proactive in introducing mandatory audit firm rotation. I'll explain in a minute why. But also, we are aware of these developments around us globally and locally. I've talked about the market concentration and dominance of the large firms. The comprehensive regulation is part of our four pillars because we believe that if there is an audit failure or a business failure, we believe that it's a systemic failure. It's a whole system that fails. And we have to look at all those, and that is why we support the comprehensive regulation, where all those in the chain should be reversed. But that is something different to what I'm going to talk about now. And the measures that we've introduced already is we prohibit audit firms from providing audit and other services. Otherwise, effectively, they'll be auditing their own work and self-advocacy threats, and we've introduced mandatory audit firm rotation. Now, just to be clear, the board decided to introduce mandatory audit firm rotation. That decision has been taken. When I talk about the process forward, it's really just the implementation of that decision. Just as a background, we see corporate failures continuing to shape the regulatory reforms all over the world. Europe, America, locally. Every time there's an audit failure or a business failure, regulators step in, regulators respond, oversight bodies respond. And the last financial crisis, global financial crisis, clearly again has focused the attention on auditors, but also on regulators. Are regulators like the RBA doing enough? It's one thing to blame the auditors, but also are the regulators doing enough to not prevent these failures, but at least to address or respond to these failures. Of course, if possible, it would be good if we could also prevent them. There's been high profile cases, I don't have to mention those to you, internationally Enron, WorldCom, Parmalat, and locally we've had Legionet, Vanguard, and Regal Bank. Those were big audit failures that affected investors and the public at large. Another thing that the board looked at was the global development. In the European Union specifically, the 8th directive had been introduced to strengthen auditor independence. And the European Union has given all the countries, 32 countries in Europe, the choice of introducing either mandatory audit consultation, mandatory audit tendering, or joint audits. All objectives to strengthen auditor independence. And as I mentioned, we continue to be concerned that the Big Four can result in the Big Three, and that would affect, that would be further concentration in the market. Now, these are just some of the headlines from 2015. These are the fines and the failures from audit firms globally. And you'll see, of course, you'll wonder why we only mention the Big Four firms. Doesn't mean that we're targeting the Big Four firms, but clearly, if there's going to be a big business failure, it's going to be audited by a big audit firm. And those firms, unfortunately, are only the Big Four. So any other failures don't even make the headlines. The big public interest entities are audited by the Big Four. And those are just examples over the last 2 years of the fines that have had to be paid when the audit firm is found guilty and there's been an audit failure. There's also some statistics on the penalties. Now, as I mentioned, these are huge amounts, but we're not necessarily saying that these amounts will break the firm. But add up all of these, and on our next slide, when you look at the increase in the failures, the audit failures, and the cases brought against the firms, we are concerned as a regulator that these are increasing. From 2013, when we had a few, we're now sitting in 2016, where you can see every year how these cases against the audit firms are increasing. So the audit firms are not performing at the same, they're not delivering the quality of work that regulators expect from them. These are just statistics that I'm sharing with you. What we have in place, and a lot of the responses to our manager audit firm rotation, is that there are already measures in place. But we don't believe that those measures are sufficient. The first is mandatory audit partner rotation. The Companies Act requires auditors companies to rotate every 5 years. Our own code of ethics require auditors to rotate every 7 years if it's not a company. But the reason that we don't find this sufficient is because we have never ever had a complaint from an audit partner after they've taken over the audit from another audit partner in the same firm. So you will not report your own audit partner. And if there were any issues on that audit, you'll just hide it in the firm. I'm assuming that that is what is happening because we haven't had complaints from one firm about one of their partners. Normally, when a new firm comes in, of course, they've got no allegiance to the previous auditors, and that's what we think more information will come to the fore. And of course, mandatory audit firm rotation, the main focus is the fact that a fresh pair of eyes look at this information, and there's no long and close relationship between the firm, not the partner, the firm, and the client. The Companies Act Section 9, Subsection 2 also introduced the prohibition of non-audit services, so if you do the audit, you cannot perform other services, so that also strengthened the independence of auditors, because now you didn't have to audit your own work anymore. You need to have a 5-year cooling off period if you provide other services before you can deliver the audit or provide the audit service, and we support that because the prohibition of other services. You cannot be a tax consultant, a forensic auditor, the internal auditor, and then go and audit the same client. So we fully support that. In December last year, the board decided that to introduce the independence of auditors, we will start asking auditors to disclose how long they've been the auditor of that company. Now this information wasn't available, it was available of course, but it wasn't required to be disclosed. So from January this year, every auditor has disclosed the number of years that they have been the auditor of a company. So with the audit committee, we know that at the AGMs and at the audit committees, when the proposal is made to appoint the auditor again, then the answer is normally yes. It's not, we don't believe that there's enough challenge. Nobody really looks at how long the auditor has been there. But now we're raising that information and bringing it to the fore and saying that the auditors must disclose that so that when the audit committee or the shareholders see this information, that they can think twice about whether they want to reappoint this firm if there's been long audit tenure. Other measures, of course, the new audit reporting model now requires auditors to provide a lot more information in their audit report. We call it key audit matters. And that becomes effective in around December this year, 15th of December this year. And then, of course, the integrated report also provides a lot more information. The scope of our research, we started off by looking at we had three objectives. The board had three objectives. Strengthening water independence, of course. Addressing the market concentration and see how we can provide more access to the markets by other firms. And of course, very importantly, we have to promote transformation in the profession. We are not in a position to appoint more black partners. We are not at the firms. And from our perspective, the RBA has to introduce initiatives that will make a difference and that will make a change. We're not going to look at the number of black partners you have. We want to look at the number of black people that are empowered and the opportunities to them to become empowered. And therefore, as a regulator, we have to do a lot more than just look at numbers. We asked the public to comment on three things. We said, we want to know whether you want us to introduce mandatory audit firm rotation, mandatory audit tendering, and joint audits. So the board didn't say that they're going to introduce mandatory audit firm rotation. We gave them three choices. And we received responses from various stakeholders. Now what's important in these responses that we've also provided in the consultation paper is it is important to look at the interests of the parties that are responded. And what we've heard, we had a workshop on Thursday with the audit firms, and what we've heard in that workshop is the analogy of saying that effectively when you ask auditors to vote for something that will affect their pockets, then it's almost like asking turkeys to vote for Christmas. And so the responses are very similar to that analogy. We'll see that for more mandatory audit tendering, it's more or less depending on the stakeholder. It is not such a big difference. But when you go to something like more mandatory audit firm rotation, it's very interesting to see that there was a complete rejection by the big four firms, and there was a complete rejection by the CFOs of the companies that they audit, which came to us as a little bit of a surprise, because we would expect that the CFOs and the audit committee chairs of the listed companies would welcome independence, because clearly that is good governance. But we don't know what the reasons are, but it's very telling how the votes went. For mandatory audit firm rotation, when we ask regulators and other relevant stakeholders like investors, you can see that an overwhelming 82% for mandatory audit firm rotation. So we have to look at the response from every party, but it's also important that the board looks at the interests of every party. You can't compare a regulator's interest to the interests of an audit firm. Joint audits, I think, were fairly balanced, but nobody was either hot or cold about joint audits, because we've had experience in South Africa and globally, and it's not used in many countries because it comes with great difficulties. So there I could say there was not any overwhelming support or no support for joint audits. But those are the three that we presented. The thing that we looked at the board was the initiatives, what the EU initiatives aim for. This is exactly what we aim for in South Africa. If we didn't just introduce mandatory audit consultation for one reason, there were many reasons why we introduced this, and it's similar to the EU initiatives. First of all, is to clarify and better define the role of statutory audit in respect of public interest entities. The RBA's mandate is not about the fish and chip shop around the corner. Our mandate is to look at the audit of public interest entities, because we have to protect the public interest. We also have to see how we can improve information to auditors. And that is why when the new audit reporting model came out, we had overwhelming support for it, because we want auditors to disclose more information to investors so they are better positioned to take important investing decisions. There must be more communication between auditors and their entities. There must be any conflict between the provision of audit and non-audit services. It will mitigate the risk of potential conflict, whatever is introduced, and then broadening the choice of auditors, giving more audit firms an opportunity, giving clients the opportunity to choose from audit firms, and thereby improving the independence of the firm. We are not taking the appointment of auditors in our hands as a regulator. The audit committee must still appoint the audit firm. Right? We're just concerned that they don't look at important things like the independence of the audit firm. So let me start with independence. The three objectives were independence, transformation, and concentration. And let us now share with you what our research displayed. When we looked at independence, we were concerned that there were familiarity threats between CFOs and the auditors. And when we did a correlation between the CFO of the organization and the current auditors, we found an 18% relationship of the CFO that CFO was also a partner at the audit firm that are currently auditing the firm. Now, that doesn't mean automatically that there's an independence issue. But remember, independence is not just what you see, it's also perceived independence. And when you look at the relationship between that CFO and that audit firm, it's interesting that when some of the CFOs came into the position of CFO, the auditors also changed, and it changed back to that audit firm. So these are relationships that we are picking up. Similarly, the relationship between the audit committee chair, a very important person for government, and the audit firm demonstrated a 25% correlation between who the audit committee chair was and who the auditors were. Again, they could be completely independent, but when there is on top of that a drop in audit quality or an audit failure, we start to wonder whether the relationship between the audit committee and the audit firm was not too close. The Public Investment Commission, who owns more than 12% on the JSE stock market, is our biggest investor, and this is one of the stakeholders that we had to respond to. And they have not only given raised concerns around the independence of directors, but they've also raised concerns about the independence of auditors, and they've approached the RBA to ask us if there's anything that we should be doing from our side to address the independence of auditors. And that's one of the stakeholders whose concerns you have to respond to. We issued our inspections reports last year in December, and we busy finalizing the current inspections report. And our inspection findings include a lot of ethical matters. So when it appears as if the profession might be delivering high quality audits according to ethical standards, of course there are sections of the profession that are doing excellent work. We do not have a bad profession, we have a strong profession. But there's also some pockets where in our inspections findings we have a lot of concerns around quality of audits and their ethical compliance of auditors. That you'll find in our public inspections report. Long audit tenure has become a huge concern to the RBA, and I'll share some information with you now. And of course, as a global player, we won't be number one in the world if we didn't also part of the faith in what happens globally. We don't slavishly follow what happens globally, but we have to also be aware of what happens and therefore to closely monitor international developments. So we've just made available to you the audit tenure for listed companies, and we've only put on the slide those over 40 years, but what Lorraine handed out was all the listed companies and the audit tenure. But I think when you look at the ones over 40 years, the results are shocking. And it starts with the minimum year. I mean, the rest of the handout that you've got has got tenor under 40 years, but still long. But you can see that it ranges here from 40 years to 114 years. Of course, the RBA has had a lot of responses in our first consultation, and this is what we're doing in our second consultation, is to make a further assessment of the impact analysis of mandatory audit firm rotation. But one of the concerns that have been raised that we're looking into is that the audit cost and the cost of the companies and the cost of doing business will increase. Now, the RBA cannot be irresponsible and introduce something that will have a huge impact on business and on cost for business and cost for auditors. But we've done a little bit of preliminary research, and we've looked at the change in the audit fees when there was a change in auditors, the big four firms, and for some big clients as well. So for example, when Vodacom changed their auditors from Deloitte to PwC, the audit fees went up from 22 to 26 million. So not 100%, not 200%, 4 million rand. Sasol Limited is a huge client. Their fee went up from 86 million to 87 million. Similarly for Bidvest and Famous Brands. So Famous Brands looks a little bit more because they had mergers in the period, and therefore that the company became bigger, and therefore the audit fee went up. And we wonder sometimes whether if the same audit firm continued, they might not have increased their fee more than this because they've got their 10%, 20% increase every year anyway. But this was when there was a change in auditing. And we're not saying that these are the only increases because we are going to do further research to see what the impact is on some other firms as well. But these are huge companies and huge audit firms, and this is what we've seen from one year to the next. On the second objective, and that was just on independence and the threats to independence that concern us. Long relationships, long-standing relationships, the fact that you're too close to your client, and the fact that you could miss something or deliberately hide something. We're not saying that is the case, but this is the perception from the public when you've got close and long relationships. I would like to share with you that she already mentioned a concern around market concentration. Not only there can you see that the big four firms own 96% of the market, I think, yes. That's 96% of the market, but one of the big four firms dominates with 48% of the listed companies. Now, to go back to the slide that I presented on the fines that were levied on some of these firms, especially the one that has a 48% dominance. Something happens to that firm, then our markets will be left without an auditor for 48% of listed clients. Again, we're not saying that something will happen to the firm, but as a regulator, we've got to be responsive and responsible and prepare for things like this. Possible things like this. Another argument that has been used in South Africa is the moment you speak to a big listed company or a bank and you say to them that you're going to force them to change their auditors, they'll say to us that three of the firms are conflicted because they provide other services, which means there are no audit firms left. That is not true. In South Africa, when you register with the RBA, you are a qualified auditor. You should be able to audit. We understand that in certain industries, you need specialist skills. But the audit standard says that you cannot accept a client if you don't have the skills to audit that client. So the standards prescribe to the auditor whether they can accept a client or not. This should not be left to the client themselves or to the CFOs to decide that they will not move from the big four firms, because that closes the market to everybody else. And the statistics that we presented there is just to demonstrate again that there are other international firms in South Africa and local firms with international connections that can step in to help or to audit those clients. So the RBA will never expect an audit firm to step into a bank if they're not qualified to audit a bank. And the argument that we keep on hearing is that they don't, other firms don't have the experience. But we don't know how they will ever get that experience if it's not given to them. A company won't be reckless and appoint an audit firm that cannot audit them. But surely there are firms that do have the competencies. And if you're registered with the RBA, you're a competent auditor. And you need the opportunity to be able to do that. And if the company or the CFO or the audit committee won't encourage other firms to get the opportunities, then we believe we should do something to do that. And also, again, the concentration will remain for the big four if we don't create opportunities. So this slide here just demonstrates that there are other firms with international connections. Our local firms, SFNT, Mkhonke and Sizwe, are the three biggest black firms in the, and local firms, and they are all connected to international firms as well. To come back to transformation, as I mentioned, the RBA looks at transformation in a very serious light. The statistics that you've seen earlier are not, they don't look good. And we are not going to ask audit firms to tell us whether they've got 2.5% black partners unless they empower those black partners. And therefore we went and we did some research into the racial demographics of audit partners signing off on listed companies to find that of the 370 odd listed companies, the chair will be pleased, yeah, at least we went into a bit of granularity, We have 9 African partners signing off on joint investment company. 1 Chinese, 5 colored, 33 Indian, and the majority are still white partners signing off. So 20 years into democracy, the firms are telling us that they have transformed their organizations, but they are not allowing black and African partners to sign up on JSE listed companies. And that is where real empowerment comes for us. And unless we see a change there, we are not going to be satisfied. And we have raised this with the firms to say that we are not satisfied with these kinds of statistics. We've heard a lot of other recommendations. The board didn't believe that these were strong enough, but we had to consider them, and I think
the board has no problem
to introduce these in addition to mandatory audit firm rotation. Strengthening audit committees, yes. Public disclosure of inspections report, yes. Enhanced audit committee report.
Well, I should check something. We're very close to 100%. Can you guys say, unfortunately, you can't. So, can you come back at 2?
Certainly.
Because you're reading a lot more than we bargained for and as we promised. And it's fine, but as long as you stay. If you don't have to do the whole army of people, just 2 or 3 people, you're ready to run. But in that case, how much more time do you need?
Chair, for the presentation I'm done. 2
more
slides, time. Yeah. So maybe I can finish that.
Yeah.
But then I'd really be happy to engage with the committee at 2.
Yeah,
well,
we're
not now. We're not up to 1 o'clock. Okay. Thanks, Jeff. Strengthening the audit regulator, increase above penalties, and then also help audit committee chairs with audit quality indicators. Those are all suggestions that we support. But I think it's important that the committee is aware of the challenges that we are currently facing in implementing mandatory audit firm rotation. And this resistance, strangely enough, doesn't only come from the auditors, it is also coming from the clients. And we don't know what the reasons are why clients or companies wouldn't want to change their auditors, but the resistance has been strong from the companies, listed companies, saying they do not want to change their auditors and they won't accept this decision. So under the challenges, we have resistance to change in practices and patterns, and as we know, there are age-old patterns that exist where the partner leaves the audit firm, becomes the audit committee chair, the CFO, appoints the ex-firm, and we have examples of those patterns. And those patterns will never be broken. It will continue like that for the next 114 years if we don't do something to stop those patterns. And as you can understand, when there's change, or when change is required, then there will be. We've also been challenged on our authority as the audit regulator to regulate auditors and to introduce mandatory audit firm rotation. Our Act clearly says that is our mandate. But some of the challenges now is that it should be with the DTI, it should be in the Companies Act. I agree that when something affects the company, it should be in the Companies Act, but auditors' independence and ethics is in the mandate of the RBA, and we shouldn't be challenged on our mandate. The motives, of course, we have to consider. I mentioned the analogy of the turkeys voting for Christmas. That was mentioned at the workshop on Thursday, and we must just keep in mind that there would possibly be self-interest involved when we look at the responses that we are receiving. Exactly what it is, we can't tell. Also, there's been a lot of resistance to the fact that we're trying to achieve transformation, concentration, and independence with mandatory audit firm rotation. The RBA believes that we can address all those issues. But the public auditors and companies have started to conflate the issues. So they're saying you can't achieve independence through this because it won't address transformation, etc. But we still believe strongly that we can achieve all these objectives with mandatory audit firm rotation. And we have even been told that we will be challenged legally for introducing mandatory audit firm rotation. They're willing to take it to the Constitutional Court because certain companies and auditors won't accept the decision. We've consulted from July 2015 to 2016 before the board took the decision. I'll share those results with you. We further opened a public consultation process from October to January this year. And during this process, the RBA has kept the Treasury and the Ministry involved and consulted with them and reported progress to them throughout the process. So So the final requirement that the board has introduced is that all audit firms must rotate of public interest companies. Not all companies, public interest, must rotate every 10 years. Listed companies, must rotate every 10 years with effect from 2023. The reason we made it 2023 is because Section 90, Subsection 2 of the Companies Act requires a 5-year cooling off period if you're providing other services. And it allows the companies and firms to settle in and to plan properly, and that's why we gave them up to 2023. And then transition arrangements, if you're on a joint audit, then you don't have to rotate over the same time. One firm can rotate up, the other one gets 2 extra years, so that both firms don't rotate over at the same time. Thank you very much, Chair.
Yeah, very good story.
Justice, I apologize for expecting you from the other meeting. It doesn't matter. Yeah, sorry about that. I know you have several conditions. But to explain to you, there's an IRBA met me in August. The meeting was and the agreement was that we would in some form or another invite the media. A lot more has come out in the event. It's a bit more complex than I can assume. And I'm aware to some extent, and I'm sure others are, about the resistance. But it does surprise you when certain people are resisting. I mean, if I look at some of the characters, it would be surprising. And the committee should look like he's popular. But on the whole, he has no choice in majority yet. This thing of these countries coming in, I'm sure there is a lot of debate about something about it. But as to how you achieve the goal, we can discuss strategies, tactics, confrontation, deadlines, so on, phasing, and so on. But as for the 96%, I want this discussion with the ANC. It's nice. Can I just say it simple? We think about this. I'm standing on the ANC. So I think we need to look at modalities. That's what other companies have in mind. And so on. Having said that, I will come in later. Now, we have about 15 minutes left. Let's see how many people want to speak. And they're finally turned up in Romania, Greece, Stockholm, France. So, in the first round, so to speak, maybe some of these 4 minutes. And then those of you who haven't spoken with the trade forward since 2 o'clock. Quite about you, I keep reminding you, you can tell us, it's 2:15. Remember, we came in late, you have to go into the house, sign and leave.
When?
At 2 o'clock.
Oh.
Sign there and then leave at 2:15, we're back here. We will then go and vote. I think it's a bit of a revenue vote that we have to vote on and maybe one of the other votes. I will check with the programming works during the live stream. Mm-hmm. ANC members, you're required to be elsewhere at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Chair. Before I ask my question, can you allow me to say to Irva that I envy their responsibility? I don't want to be them.
No, you're allowed to say it.
Yeah. But I can say bravo for what they've done so far. They will have an idea what I'm talking about. Chair, my focus will first start on... let me say a rider. I will not talk about democratic because I know which institution to approach when we're talking about a balanced demographic relationship with shared accounts in South Africa. I used to do that when I said the portfolio committee on public. So it's not Irma, it's those ones. I would have wanted to ask hundreds of questions again. But let me ask this. On the issue of the mandatory audit firm measure rotation, I 100% agree with you. And that's the issue that we must not lose focus on. Actually, I would have said that you must even look at who in the AGM are recommending who should be the auditor. Because then you'll establish a pattern of the same individuals who are in the internal audit committees who are doing recommendations about which firm to audit. So if you don't even look at the AGM itself, you will not come to the bottom of what is happening. So what needs to happen? Well, I'm very confused at because I used to be in the DTI. So when I speak here, I don't know where I stand. My other leg is here, my other leg is there. When the company was formulated, I was there in the DTI. So I'm in trouble to choose who to agree with in relation to who sets mandate and authority to because you know, I used to be Rob's deputy editor. But the most interesting part that you need to look at is this public interest entity that doesn't want scrutiny. They will be found wanting in relation to who they choose as auditor. And that question might arise today, for instance. Somebody might say, why is SAA refusing to be audited by the Auditor General, for instance? You know? And whether it's public perception or it's based on fact, we know that when people work together, they establish a rapport. Starting from those lower level auditors to the one who gives the account. So you might find that the CFO has a particular relationship with somebody in Deloitte or in PwC, for instance. And for argument's sake, anybody who's going to audit your books, they will want to be on your good side. They want that account. They want every 5 years. So if every 5 years they clinch the deal, they know that they must give a good report. Otherwise, they're not going to clinch the deal. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know those facts. And they will do it in such a way that it will not be discovered by anybody. As I was saying, you are not clever enough to ask to keep more money and you get to take it back to National Treasury or to the revenue fund because you even hide it somewhere within the books. For it. I'm not saying you must do it. I was just being naughty around it. So they will do it in such a way that the report will look good in the public eye, but it will give them the views. Because I suspect the plan to research prerequisites on how they must audit and what they should audit and what they should not audit. Then they will give them a clean bill and that's it. So if you should set those standards. If the act that establishes you, give you that authority and the mandate and the power, is the power that you should be able to unleash and utilize. And I'm not going to be apologetic as the chair to say let's not be over ambitious and populist in the statement. I don't intend to do this. The issue is, if you want to achieve your transformation agenda, you will not achieve it in an environment where there is no competition, where there is no opportunities for new entrants to get into the market. Because you will have those who saturate the market, who are more experienced, who have been given this account. I mean, if somebody can get an account for 100 years, for argument's sake, do you think you can compete with that when a new entrant? Of course you will not. So it's an issue that through the standards that you set, you'll be, as the authority that you utilize, you'll be able to achieve. So it's a matter of and I'm happy that today you gave the statistics that shows how many firms are black. Well, we've always known going into the Daluba for all these years as being the only that actually has international standards. I used to ask, what is it in this examination that chartered accountants are writing when they actually pass at the university level, when they go to this authority, they cannot go past it. That makes them not to qualify. I used to ask that question. I used to ask when I was in defense, what is in the psychometric test that makes somebody who passed in flying colors not to pass psychometric test? I mean, it's a psychometric test. And those were measures put in place to make others to get into barriers to entry. So, unfortunately, we don't have immediate answers to that, Chair. But having listened to this presentation, you can see the hard work that RBA has been doing to try to... And we don't want you to lower the standards. We don't want you to lower the auditing standards, because then that will open up to corruption, where people who don't qualify will just come in. But that doesn't suggest that with the type of democratics we have in South Africa, we have other people who can enter this market with excuses that they don't qualify. Well, we know it's not the case. It's just gatekeeping from those big businesses and those who are privileged ones to continue to be there and not open up. So you're doing a good job and well done for that. Thanks.
Right. Next, please, whoever you are or are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, thank you to Herbert for the presentation. There's a great deal of concerns here, so I'm just curious about a couple of things, and then hold my brief for further consideration. The interesting thing is the question of the auditor general. Are they a member? Because they audit a huge number. And so what happens then in terms of the rotation, mandatory rotation, for them if they move the company? I know that you're saying listed companies, and we now talk people who think these are not companies. But surely there's room here to discuss this, because for the very same reason. When you talk about this as customer companies trying to protect the shareholder and others, surely with the state department, there's an even stronger that there should be protection of similar protection. So it's a thought and wondering whether it's been considered it. Because there is a view that says that the Auditor General should not always more and more state-owned entities and so on. So how does that happen? Then in terms of the investigations that you do, they've been published, is there, if someone lodges an objection, and there's a self-interest, I'm sure you have that, what is the feedback that you give to a complainant?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the comprehensive explanation. A passing comment, I looked at your board in the annual report. And I see that all of your board members except one are CAs. Does that make a balanced board? I know you are regulating accountants, but if you could just comment on that. Why do you want to support Africa? I know that I disagree with that, but you never elaborated as to the reason why you want to do that. Just take us into confidence as far as it's concerned. And then another, apart from ranking, what are the other reasons that the auditors are advanced for opposing rotation? We have to speak about the concentration of the number of events, but I just wanted to check. We'll see whether there is a too big to fail problem when it comes to the Austin trend. And also, if that's the case, then we must But I just wanted to check that apart from moral suicide, what are they trying
It's very good to know that I'm a Kembeck and I talk. We used to work with government. No, I worked with him before.
Very young. Very young.
I worked with him.
And so on. And it's the same thing happening in the advocate sector. Advocate is sort of right. I've been complaining about. Now, obviously, there's a whole series of balancing to do. But the one we can't move away from. What I'm saying is, you have to carry people with you the way I see it. It's something that I've been taught by the movement that I've come from. It's something that drums people, by the journey of carrying people. It's about timing and phasing. I don't think it's just what you're saying, but I'm saying it's just maybe the choice of words. I have to achieve a phase of the which I do believe in my way. So, you know, you've got a deadline to see a 2017. Now, one of the things I want them to think about is just call them. Just ask them what's your problem. They call you here and trace you. I was also to alert you that I'm aware they're campaigning at the highest level, including in the department. And there are all sorts of sensitivities around managing this process. That's all I'm referring to. I think if we talk outside this meeting, what are you going to do? It's the same method. I think that we don't need to, what I'm suggesting to members, we don't need to finish everything now. I think we call you back. We're going to put that down, please, and see. But we actually consider calling you back. But to assist the process, we look into actually having a bit of a hearing where we invite emerging companies, we invite the established monopolies, and yourself, and whoever else was the trade union and so on. You know, and we signal that in the statement we issued today.
Oh, tomorrow.
What?
Issued tomorrow.
Issued tomorrow.
Yes, I'm working very hard here.
Okay, yeah, okay, to warm. We are very glad we deployed you as a
test. Up here to warm.
See, maybe we look at all, because it would be premature for me as a chair to say something if the committee hasn't applied its mind fully. So it's something we can issue tomorrow, you're right, and it's hard to compete with certain other things that we can say. So tomorrow morning, I can even, having concurred with you and Justice, come with a statement here, and we can collect the issue, see whether you agree with it. So, that's what I'm suggesting. So it's 1 o'clock, it's lunch even for you, especially for you. members of the ALC, you have no choice, fully Margaret instructed all of us. We feel that since we have resistance,
that we will sometime early in the next quarter get a call and a hearing. That's what it would be now. A hearing on the invite form and everything. You see, maybe we should do this and then we can sit for the whole day without having. So that's more or less the line that we can issue. We also have to realize that this is the wrong group that I have here at all, and maybe we should carefully consider things and ask them to come tomorrow. We think about this with your colleagues to talk to. But I also think we can help you. Also, it's a bit late in the day. So that would be, So that's a little bit of a challenge for now, and then we'll think about what I'm saying and take the discussion forward. Thank you very much. Can the non-ANC members just recognize the hierarchy?